We are the people of God, called out from the world and chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to that great day when the reign of Christ will fill the earth. It is good to be together this morning. I'm glad you have come, and I trust you have come anticipating a great time of worship of our God and fellowship with his people. Teenage years are terrible, at least most of them, or some of them. They're very difficult because they're fraught with this nagging question for most teenagers, who am I? Because I can't figure it out. I remember well when that question began to plague me more intensely than at any other time in my growing up years. I had just entered college. I was a freshman at Michigan State University, and I went there thinking I was a pretty smart guy. I mean, I'd graduated at the top of my class in high school. I'd done pretty well academically. And then by the random pick of a draw, my roommate, was an honors college electrical engineer student who took 23 credit hours a semester and finishes undergrad in 3 years instead of four. I must be stupid. I'm no scholar, I thought. Who am I? While I was at college, I went there thinking that, you know, I'm a reasonably good athlete. I did well in high school sports and played several sports and did well in them. And then I came to this big university where, well, the guys playing around me in the intramural basketball team were all state ball players who couldn't play alongside Magic Johnson and a bunch of other pretty good ball players. And I realized, I'm not an athlete. Who am I? And then I remember thinking, well, I want to be popular. I have a lot of friends that usually, so I'm going to do all that I can to be a popular guy. And then I realized that to be popular in my dorm on the second floor of Shaw Hall, that of the 60 people there, well, you really had to party every week, drink from the keg, and smoke pot. And I wasn't into the party scene, and it began to bug me. Who am I? And those were tough years of identity confusion. If you've been through them, you know what I'm talking about, right? And probably the only thing worse than being a teenager during those years is trying to parent someone who's a teenager during those years, right? We first heard about the issues related to identity confusion and identity crisis from a psychologist named Eric Erickson back in the 60s. He's the man who coined the idea of an identity crisis. But we have since done a lot more study and realized that identity crises don't occur just for people when they're teenagers. In fact, issues of identity confusion and identity diffusion and identity difficulties spring up all the way through life. They don't end when you graduate out of the teen years. Now, there are so many things in our culture and our society that cause us to question, who am I? And not be able to come up with a good answer. Now we're told that we need to decide our gender. Are you male or female or neither? We need to decide our sexual orientation. Are you homosexual or heterosexual or bisexual? We need to decide where to go to college and what career to pursue, and there are now thousands of choices available to us. Who am I? And along the way, it's not unusual for us to build our identity along things like the roles that we play. We consider ourselves a father or a mother or a wife or a daughter or a son or an engineer or a hiker or a runner or a grandparent or an American. And none of those things are necessarily evil or bad. But each of those identities can become so strained and competing and even lost. for those who are mothers and fathers and grandparents, kids grow up. If you're a spouse, spouses die. Jobs are lost. Retirement seizes us. America shifts from what the America that we thought we knew, and our bodies will fail. And with each change comes a recognition that some part of our identity is being lost. Who am I? Psychologists tell us that navigating through these different changes of our identity is part of the normal course of human development. Well, perhaps so, but failure to do it well is debilitating. It can lead to disaster, depression, despair, and in the worst cases, even perhaps cause people to think about just stepping out of life altogether. Who am I? I don't know, but I don't like me. So I'll just give up. What is our true identity? What can we think about ourselves that is really true? Not based on an advertisement, not based on a fantasy, not based on an aspiration, but something that is rooted in reality. Truth. An identity that won't change tomorrow, whether life takes us to the mountaintop or crashes us in the valley. We would like that kind of a true identity. This morning, we're going to look into God's Word, and my hope is that we will be so amazed at the identity that God sets before us, for us, that we will walk out here incredibly encouraged. That we will say my identity and what God has established for us is anchoring me for the rest of life. In order to do that, we're going to look at a text that gives for us really kind of three privileges that we have as God's people. Three privileges, three facts that God has given to us that really establish for us our true identity. And once we cover those three privileges, we'll look at a response that we might make and an encouragement to embrace those very privileges. Now, think about with me for a minute. Back in the first century, this same question existed. There were different issues of the day, but they still had to go through life wondering, who am I, really? Because the New Testament, in the Epistle of 1 Peter that we'll be looking at, it was written to people, some of whom were probably Jews. And as Jesus followers, they were kicked away out and away from traditional Israel and Judaism. Perhaps some of the readers were Romans. And the Roman people looked at these Jesus followers and said, we don't want you around here, you who follow a criminal that was crucified for insurrection. Likely some of these people had family members back home, extended family, moms and dads and brothers and aunts and uncles that they used to live with. But because they were now following Jesus, they had been kicked out of the family. And they were dispersed all around the Mediterranean. And they were going through their lives wondering, who am I? What's my true identity? And it's into that situation that Peter writes these verses, an encouragement for them. And an encouragement for us as well. So we jump in. What is the first privilege that we have? We are privileged to be positioned as a new temple. We're privileged to be positioned as a new temple of God. We're in 1 Peter chapter 2. I invite you to turn there. 1 Peter chapter 2. We'll be looking all together at verses 4 through 10. I want to just turn your attention for the moment at verses 4 and 5. Look how in several different ways, Peter talks about believers as a new temple. Verse 4 in 1 Peter 2, as you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are built into a, what? A spiritual house. That's a temple. To be a holy priesthood offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. In so many words, what Peter is saying to his reader is that they're privileged to be positioned as a new temple, as the primary connection point between heaven and earth, as the point of contact between God and humankind. The key line is there in verse 5. You saw it, right? Where he says that you are living stones built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood offering spiritual sacrifices. What a mouthful. There's several important aspects here in this line that you'll want to pay attention to. First of all, a spiritual house. That's the key idea. It refers to a new temple. It's and he's not talking about a church building. Sometimes when we think about a house, we think about a building. And even though he's going to allude to the temple, he's talking about a spiritual house, which means it's not a physical one. He's talking, I think, here about this. This is something for his readers would be closely aligned with the Old Testament. Now, perhaps the concept of temple doesn't exactly excite us, nor does the idea of being a living stone. It doesn't help us with our identity. You know, we think of temples. Let's see, there's... I know there's a Buddhist temple up there in Richardson, and I think they had a temple in the Old Testament. We don't have really good ideas of what that might mean for them in Peter's day. And priests, well, we don't think a lot about priests here at Centerpoint. We know some other churches do have priests, and they wear certain clothing and perform certain acts, but seems pretty distant to us. What's going on here? The temple was the primary reason, or I should say manifestation, for God's work in Israel. It was the center point of his work in their nation. It was the avenue for Israel to meet with God. Throughout the Old Testament, Israel was frequently told, you don't get to worship God every place that you go. You don't get to have sacrifices out in the bushes and out in the villages, out in the towns. You're going to bring your sacrifices to the temple because here is where God's presence is going to be made known. And the same was true for the nations, that the temple was the place to which the nations were invited. So it would be through the temple, right, that God's people and the witness to the nations would take place. Israel was set in the land so that God's presence could be displayed in the temple. So any reference to the temple for a first century reader would have had to imply in their minds, the temple! That's where God does all his work! And Peter says to these believers, you are a spiritual temple. That's where God shows up. Yeah. It's among you, Peter says. We don't have anything quite like that in our existence. I mean, it would be like, this is a terrible analogy, it's the best I could think of. It'd be like taking the Statue of Liberty and the Lord's Table and putting them together into something that were two of the most important elements of our existence, both nationally and spiritually. The temple did that for Israel. That was where it all came down to in terms of their relationship with God. You're a spiritual house. And when he wrote that, the people of the first century likely would have thought about the last time they were in Jerusalem and saw Herod's temple. It was the second temple, a temple that was of gargantuan size. Some of you have been to Israel and you've had the opportunity to walk along the Western Wall. The Western Wall goes under where the temple was, and it has some blocks of stone supporting that wall on which the temple would be built. They're as large as this auditorium. But can you imagine? Strings of blocks set on top of each other with a temple on top of that? It was glorious. It was awesome. And for someone to say that we're going to the temple, that we're going to see the temple, would have captured in them all great kinds of sense of, this is wonderful, it's glorious, just to stand and look at it takes your breath away. And Peter says, God's building you into a spiritual house. captivating their attention. But the old temple was made of dead stones. They were dressed, carved, carefully put in place, but they're just stones. And Peter says to his readers that you are living stones, that this temple is going to be constructed of people, and there are people who are related to Christ, the stone, the living stone. And then he says to be a holy priesthood. Oh, my heavens. Why would that be important for a New Testament congregation? To be a holy priesthood in the Old Testament meant that these are the people who are going to stand between God and man and do a couple of things. They're going to, first of all, they're going to represent God before the people. And second, they're going to take the people's sacrifices and offer them to God. They are going to be a channel that connects worshipers to God himself. And for Israel to be a holy priesthood as a nation at the temple, they were going to be a nation of priests, not just a nation with priests in it, a priestly nation who indeed embraced all the nations of the world. You're a temple, a holy priesthood that would gather the nations to worship God. And then he says that this temple project is God's building project. Did you see it? What does it say? You are being built, right? You're being built in verse 5. Who's doing the building? It's God. He's building his people into this spiritual house. It's not a temple built by Herod. It's not a temple built by fallible engineers. It's not a temple that's going to be built by men and women who make mistakes. This one's built by God. And notice he's not saying that each individual is a priest. He's not saying that each individual is a temple. The Apostle Paul in other places of the New Testament talks about your bodies as a temple. That's not the point here. The point here is the people of God collected form this new temple, this new place where God's presence is made manifest and on display. And like a kingdom, like a royal holy priesthood, it brings the nations before him in worship. Imagine the encouragement to that first group of believers. Kicked out of Rome, kicked out of Jerusalem, abandoned by their families, wondering who on earth they really are as Jesus followers. Probably feeling like a bunch of nobodies. And Peter says, hey, you and you all around the Mediterranean, you are living stones being built by God into a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, offering sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus. Yeah, that's who we are. May I suggest to you that that privileged position is not true just in the New Testament, but true for us as well. That we are in this same privileged position as connectors between heaven and earth, between God and humans. What a wonderful position to be in. It's a project bigger than you and I can even imagine. I mean, think of it. We think of our lives as, I'm building a family. I'm building a career. I'm building a house. I'm building a legacy. I'm building a nest egg for retirement. But this is not something that we build. This is something that God builds. So much bigger than our projects. It means that we, not just Centerpoint, but the believers across the world today, the believers of years past, the believers who will come in the years ahead, are all identified as the primary vehicle for God's representation of himself on the world. Mind-blowing. That's who you are. That's who I am. So when it comes to going to church, funny phrase, really, going to church, it's not something that we do just to improve our lives. Going to church is not simply an activity to do because God commanded it. Going to church is not something to do simply because it's a tradition of our families, but rather going to church, meaning coming together as God's people, is an expression of our true identity. For it is this coming together where we get to say to one another and to the world, we are being built by God into this grand new temple, spiritual house, a holy priesthood. It is a privilege to be together, to express that. And when we leave our meeting, we're not leaving. What we are doing is we are still part of this spiritual house. We are still part of this collection of living stones that God is using on display in the world. Let's think about the nuts and bolts of when you get up tomorrow. It's easy for you, perhaps, to think, well, I'm a father, or I'm a mother, or I'm a husband, or I'm a wife, or I'm a son, or I'm a daughter, or I'm an engineer, or I'm a janitor, or I'm a teacher. Great, these are the roles that we play. They're the functions that we take in life, but these are too small to be our true identity. In fact, all of those will change through life. But this identity, it endures to the end. It's bigger than all that. It subsumes all of that. Because we are living stones. We are people whom God is placing to build his new temple, his expression of himself, connecting heaven and earth. Wow. That's great. That's our privilege. And it helps us anchor our true identity in reality. There's a second privilege in this text, and it comes from us to us in verses 6 through 8. Notice what he says. As he talks about the privilege of our protected status, I was going to quote a bunch of Old Testament verses, and these are a little bit confusing, but stay with me because there's an argument here that says, you who are living stones, you are protected in that status. Notice as I read, verse 6. For in Scripture it says, see, I lay in Zion a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him, key line, will never be put to shame. Now, to you who believe, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the believers rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone that causes people to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble and because they disobey the message, which is what they were destined for. Peter is talking about the status that we have as living stones being protected in this new temple, preserved there. And the key lines, he actually is contrasting the experience of believers and unbelievers. He says, with the believers, you will never be put to shame. That's the shame of destruction. Peter is using the first of three Old Testament quotations in this little set of verses. And here he refers to how the stone is placed in Zion in Isaiah chapter 28. And in that place, what's happening is that Jerusalem is undergoing destruction. But the stone seems to indicate that God himself is going to be faithful and Zion will not all be destroyed. Some will be preserved. They're going to be protected amidst the destruction that's coming with the exile. The stone is going to symbolize for them protection and preservation. God set the stone in place. And then the same word is used toward the end of this passage where God sets or establishes the destiny for those who reject the stone. Because for them, that destiny is going to be stumbling and tripping and falling over and destruction. People stumble and trip over the stone, bringing this destruction upon themselves. And the idea here is that God has set that stone in place of Jesus himself. And for some, Jesus will be the wonderful salvation that preserves them as living stones in the new temple. For others, they reject, they stumble, and their destiny is destruction outside that new temple. How do we know that that preservation is secure? That it's really long-lasting? That it's really going to endure to the end? Well, in fact, it's because of the way that God himself assesses Jesus. Did you notice? He says he's a precious cornerstone. In fact, he says it a couple of times in here, that I lay in Zion a chosen and precious cornerstone. That's what he is. This is one who's priceless. And when God puts Jesus in place, no one moves him. His preservation endures. We can count on it. I suspect that for the people of the first century, this was a tremendous encouragement, particularly as they knew about the distant past where the first temple was destroyed and then rebuilt. There was a cornerstone. And their second temple was going to be destroyed just a few years after this was written. And God says there's coming this new temple that is built on the Lord Jesus, and it will not be destroyed. It endures because he is precious. What an encouragement for us that we have this privileged, protected status. That, my friends, if your identity is being accepted by a certain group of people at school or at work, and they reject you, your identity will crash. It's going to happen, right? If your identity is wrapped up in getting a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a spouse and you don't get one, then your identity is going to be suffering. If your identity is wrapped up in being a good husband or a good wife, and then you're hit with divorce or death or abandonment, you will be in an identity crisis. If your identity is wrapped up in being a mom or a dad or a grandparent, and your child rebels or just plain grows up and goes away, your identity will be crushed. If your identity is based on what you do at work, and then at some point you lose your job or all appearances of success, your identity will be in a state of confusion. But here is the true identity. Preserved as living stones in a new temple. You see, it can't get crushed. Because God's doing it. And he has established the cornerstone. This we can count for all of our lives. We are privileged. We are privileged with true identity. Positioned, indeed, in his new temple. Protected in our position. And now there is a third privilege in this passage. That we are privileged to be God's own people. Privileged to be God's own people. And when I say own, I mean belonging to him. It's something very, very special. Look in verses 9 and 10. Chapter 2, back in 1 Peter. He says, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you're the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. We are privileged to be God's own people. And Peter's really cranking up the Old Testament allusions here as you get to these last couple of verses. I was joking with some of the guys before, on our preaching team. I said, this is a great passage. It only has verses 4 through 10. That's 7 verses. The problem is you need to know the entire Old Testament to really enjoy what Peter's doing here. So let's look at some of these wonderful terms that initially might seem a little distant to us, but if we could take a minute and look at the beautiful flower that's here, I think you'll say, wow, my identity is really established in the fact that I am one of God's own children. Notice how he begins with, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. All three of these terms go back to Exodus chapter 19. Now, you may not remember Exodus 19, what was happening there. Well, you'll recall that Israel had been in Egypt, right, for 400 years. And for 400 years, they were slavery. Their identity was really wrapped up in being slaves to these despotic rulers called pharaohs. More bricks without straw. You remember the story. And then God brings Moses, and he uses Moses to bring the 10 plagues and draw his people out of Egypt. And they come in chapter 19 to Mount Sinai. And this is where God is going to give to them his covenant, starting with the 10 commandments. The law is going to be given at Mount Sinai as Israel camps there for about a year. And so this is all these references to calling Israel a kingdom of priests and a holy nation are all right here on the verge of God establishing his covenant with them and saying to them, you're my people. Okay? So now here, Exodus 19, at the base of Mount Sinai, God says that you people are a chosen people. In fact, he says back in Exodus 19, although the whole earth is mine, you I've picked out for myself. All the nations belong to me, God says, but you, Israel, I've chosen for myself. And you're going to be, therefore, a holy nation. Holy means one that is set apart and distinct and chosen out from all of the others. It will lead to holy behavior. But initially, the whole idea is that just as God is separate from all of creation, so his people will be separate from all of the other nations. They will look like him in that way. And he calls them a kingdom of priests. Here the language is a royal priesthood. Why? Because it's through Israel that God is going to display his kingdom on the earth. God is the great king of all the earth, and his rule upon the earth is going to take place in this nation, in the land, through the temple, through the covenant laws. It's great. Israel is going to be able to display, or is charged with displaying, the very rule of God upon the earth, and they're going to do it as a kingdom of priests for the nations to come. Wow. This is God's entire agenda state for Israel, stated in just a few words. A chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. And you can imagine that the normal first century follower of Jesus said that was great for Israel. But what about us? Because we're no longer part of that. We follow Jesus, and they crucified Jesus, and they've booted us out. And now Peter writes to them, and he says, no, you're a holy nation, whether you're Jew or Gentile, whether you're in the land or outside the land. You're a kingdom of priests, a royal priesthood. Had to be encouraging to them and shocking to them as they realized that the commission that God had given to Israel was being transferred to them, that they could now be the conveyors, the vehicle through which God would display his rule upon the earth. Wow. And then he says this last little line in the text, you're not a people, and now you are a people. And once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. That's not from Exodus 19. That is, in fact, from the book of Hosea. And some of you remember the story of Hosea, a prophet who was told to marry a prostitute named Gomer. And these are the names of two of the children that they had in that union. One was Lo Ruhami, no mercy, because God says, I'm not showing mercy on my people who are so disobedient. And the other was going to be called Lo Ami. They're not my people. No people. In Hebrew, lo means no. No people, no mercy. Those are the children that I have. But in the next chapter, chapter 2, he says, no, let's change that. I'll forgive them. Make the Lo Ami just Ami. They're my people. Make the Lo go away. They're not Lo Ruhami, no mercy. They are Ruhami, mercy. And God says now to this first century group of believers, in your experience, there was a day when you really didn't experience the mercy of God. Now you've received mercy. There was a day when you were not known as the people of God, but now you are my people. And it had to flood them with an encouragement that says, we are privileged to be God's own special treasured possession. You belong to Him. That's your true identity. Man, I can only imagine the impact that that text had on these believers scattered about in a hostile world. But I can certainly tell you that the impact it can have on us can be significant. How wonderful it is to know we are chosen by God. That we have His mercy. That we have been claimed as His people. To be a holy priesthood, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. There's something that happens when we know we're really accepted. I remember when I was just a little guy playing Little League baseball. And they came to me one day and they said, hey, we want you to be on the traveling team. That was kind of for the All-Stars. And I was like, oh, I've been accepted. And my identity took a new optimistic turn. And then later in high school, they said, hey, you're going to be a starter on the football team and a starter on the basketball team. And I remember with each one of those announcements, it was like my identity took another kind of step forward, a leap up that said, wow, it's so good to be chosen like that. And then when Cindy said, yes, I'll marry you, I thought, oh, now here's a really important acceptance. And those are fun acceptances that do help our small identities. But here's one that makes all the others pale in insignificance. When God says to us, you're my people. You're mine. I've chosen you. The King of the universe. The God who has always existed and will always exist. The one who is perfect in all His ways has made you and you and you and you His family. How wonderful. So let's just put it all together. We are privileged people, privileged to be positioned as God's new temple, protected in this place, preserved as His new people, and privileged to be His people who've received mercy. How do you respond to that? What do you do with that? Let's embrace our true identity. Embrace our true identity. Grasp it. Believe it at the very core of our being. It's hard to do that because the church is often characterized outside as, well, you know, it's a nice place to go. I guess they give you a lot of help, right? It's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. So you can go there and sit down and get some good help for your life, and it's good stuff. It's nice to have a church where they do good things for other people. It's non-profit charity, and it's kind of like Robin Hood. They, you know, rob from the rich and give to the poor. So the church is okay. Oh yeah, the church. You know, I know about that place. That's that social club kind of, isn't it? You have everybody dresses up nice, and they have kind of slick marketing, and but then those preachers, they kind of fleece people for all their money. You see, the world looks at the church. And if we take what they see as our identity, we'll be discouraged. My friends, our identity comes from here. And we embrace this identity that we're positioned as God's people, preserved in his new temple, as his people. When we find our other identities crumbling in life, whether it's the good identities we've chosen or even some that weren't so well advised, remember this, your true identity, that you are positioned with all the believers of the ages being built by God into this new temple, right? And will be preserved there as his people. Some of you came in this morning, and I got to suspect that your identity is really in conflict. And perhaps for you, you've never really grappled with an identity of what it would be like to be part of this big building project from God. I'm not talking about our local church. I'm talking about what God is doing in forming a people for himself. My friend, today, your whole identity can take on a whole different change. It can be a true identity by trusting in this cornerstone, the one who's precious. I'd love to talk to you about that. If that's part something that you're going through, I know that the elders could be here, and Andy'd love to talk with you. I'd love to share with you a little bit more about what it means to see Jesus as precious and the cornerstone of your life. Life is filled with a lot of adjustments to our identity, from the teen years to the twilight years. We'll probably have to make some adjustments. But the core of it must come from this true identity. My friends, together, let's embrace it, shall we? And so, our Father, we know that we can face tomorrow with great anticipation because you have so locked in for us who we are. And we confess it is not of our doing. It is not from our skill or intelligence, certainly not from our wisdom. But you have been so gracious to us to privilege us like this. Father, deepen our faith this morning, I pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen.